This is tape two, side two, Bowles interview 8/20/87.
Now, Arnold had no first-hand concept of meteorological problems. That was too much. When I first went down to Washington, I was invited by Stimson in to hear a general, young general in the Air Forces who had just returned from Alaska. And I remember he was telling Mr. Stimson the weather was foul. And no doubt Arnold was told all of this. Later, there was a meteorologist who went into Navy uniform. I'll think of his name in a moment for
Carl
you.
Rothby, do you not know something about Carl Rothby, Wilhelm Berkness?
Carl Rothby, that's a little different.
But he's not the one you're thinking of?
No, you're right, but I mean, Carl Rothby is the one who came over here. First job was to help survey the way of for United Airlines.
It wasn't Dr. Houghton from MIT, H-O-U-G-H-T-O-N?
No. A scoundrel in my judgment, but which is what I was coming to. This man is still, I believe, selling his wares today. It'll come to my mind. And he was forecasting weather a week ahead and more. And Arnold very much impressed with him.
Are you hungry?
Are you ready?
Yes, you are. Yeah.
I think this might be a good time to break.
And
Continuing with our interview with Dr. Bowles after a break for lunch. I want to go back and cover a couple of things. I think we've kind of laid out a broad picture of the RAND situation. When you were, you know, engaging in the B-29 study, one of the things that you highlighted as important about that work was allowing the aircraft company to have access to
intelligence
information.
Right.
How did they respond to this new opportunity? What did they think of having this intelligence to work with and doing design work?
I go back. Don Douglas, very cooperative, and I say that I was not only dealing with Raymond, but with Don Douglas himself. And I don't try to rationalize it, but Douglas was, I think, truly an innovator, and as you probably know better than I, people that went ahead and founded Kindleberger, for example, was originally a Douglas man, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And the people who started Boeing were Douglas, unless I'm mistaken. People who founded Boeing were...
I think there were some Douglas people.
Yes.
Yes.
In other words, Don Douglas was the great instrument. And he was like all people that if you don't like him, you call him radicals. But he he believed in air. And not only that, he carried out his beliefs by making airplanes. And during the war, the DC-3, was a great, played a great part in World War II. Likewise, the Jeep, that played a great part in World War II. In other words, I put Douglas down as a great innovator. And his contribution to the war effort by the development of transport aircraft, and as well as fighter aircraft, along with the old standby, the DC-3, was a great contribution. Now, North American, as I remember it, the Kindleberger, I believe, turned out the C-45. And that was an advance based on what Douglas had learned about transport and fighter bombers and fighters. And the C-45 was a tremendous contribution on the part of the Kindleberger element in North American. I hope I'm getting the names straightened out. I don't know where we go on from here.
Well, do you recall any particular excitement's not the proper word, but interest in the opportunity to have access to this new kind of information which was not available before?
Trying to put myself in place of the industrial groups, I do not remember any appeal to me as being close to Arnold to have such access.
You're speaking of before the B-29 study.
Yes. I have to be careful because I know if people rose from the dead, they would argue that they were intensely interested, but it wasn't felt. And I don't believe Arnold was ever approached on the subject from the industry. Now, please understand, that's not trying to condemn the industry, but I wasn't in the industry. So I wouldn't have been heard, I wouldn't have heard the gossip back and forth among the industrial groups. I think my feeling is that at the beginning of the war, World War II, forgetting all idealism, they were interested in the business. I don't mean to denigrate their contribution, but their interest was in survival, as opposed to a great plan that might revolutionize what was going on. And that doesn't mean I thought that I was operating as a revolutionary. I simply felt the need, and my association with Hap Arnold led me to do things that I could never otherwise have done because I did find him responsive. Despite all my statements about his mercurial nature, temperament,
Well, let's focus on that again for a minute. I wonder whether you were part of the discussions or decisions that led to the establishment of a Deputy Chief of Air Staff for Research and Development that came about the same time that this RAND idea was coming
through. No, I plead guilty. I saw no hope for altering the view of Wright Field in the modern art of electronics, whatever that may mean. I didn't see arising from that area any what I would call unusual talent. Now, part of that, in trying to rationalize it, I believe was caused by this army system, the military system, notably in the Air Force and the Army, of moving people from point to point, giving them a complete change in responsibility arbitrarily. Now, I grant behind it, in here and there, were some tendency to exercise judgment. For instance, I got mixed up a little bit with intelligence. And after the war, they wanted me to come in and give some advice on the technical aspects of intelligence gathering. Beadle Smith, who came over from his job as second to Eisenhower, was head of what became CIA. I found that there was an extraordinary collection or condensation of legal minds. When they didn't know what else to do with a lawyer, they put him in CIA. And to use an unkind expression, it was infested with lawyers as I got into it. And a lawyer, it seems to me, by constitution, is an expert on anything. I mean, by that, he can take one side or the other in a case, orient himself, and from then on he knows all about that particular subject. I mean, he goes to court and fights on it. With the legal talent making all the judgments, I believe we suffered because of, I don't say the failure of intellectual effort, but the inability to put their fingers on able people. I mean by that, people able on a particular task. That's what I discovered in the organization. And it was similar to that in Army intelligence, because I knew some of the real people in it. And some of the most brilliant ones were brilliant lawyers, and they were able. But there wasn't what we might call an able administrative point of view, a broad view. I think that permeated the military structure, and I don't think I succeeded in doing much about it in the Air Force because Wright Field, I'm sure, reverted to form. Despite my appearance down there with Arnold.
Well, can you tell me how this discussion relates to the establishment of this post of Deputy Chief of Staff for Research and Development?
All right. I knew Arnold's confidence in LeMay. I believe I was responsible for Arnold assigning LeMay to the new office of, what was it called, research and development or something like that. I felt that it would be better to have a strong man in the headquarters in Washington, headquarters of the Air Corps, who knew nothing about research and development. And I sold Arnold on the idea of moving LeMay into that job. This was after he had done his job in Korea. And I'm sorry.
In Germany, you must
be. In the Air Force, the 20th Air Force. And maybe I undid myself, because looking back and trying to pick judgments of that sort of part, I think it was a colossal area on a mistake on my part, because LeMay didn't rise to it in any way. It didn't stimulate him. And this gets back, Arnold had discovered that LeMay's temperament, and he was a combat officer, a very successful one in the Air Force, I guess one of the most successful in that job. Now, the only place on LeMay where I managed to hit a load, LeMay was dissatisfied with the training of his air crew, notably the bombardiers, because he did have the idea that if the bombardier wasn't equal to his job, the mission was of no consequence. In fact, it was a detriment, because it was a costly thing that didn't accomplish anything. I talked with him about it at one stage when he was deputy commander of the 20th Air Force. And as I recall it, and this should be clear somewhere from my records, I got Shockley on the job. And as I remember it, he went out to India to the command of the headquarters of the 20th Air Force, where LeMay held forth, and went into the training of these men. And LeMay was complimentary, as far as I'm concerned. He said, in effect, I knew what was wrong, or thought I did. But he said, Shockley's counsel was very helpful in that it confirmed my feelings about the lack of an adequate training of our bombardiers. And that was a kind of a cue to me that we needed to re-examine this whole business of training, where you pluck the bombardiers out of this and you ground crews out of this a bunch and didn't have any system of training a crew.
What I'd like to get clear is how this position of Deputy Chief of Staff for Research and Development related to the RAND concept, if it did at all.
I don't think I ever had a heavy discussion with LeMay on what was known as Project RAND. First of all, the name RAND, it wasn't propagated in the Air Force, Air Corps. And I was the last one to go beating a drum with a new acronym. It wasn't my own. And in this diary, office diary, you'll see that I managed to collect almost everybody in the Air Force, and it was General Spotts who did introduce the subject, and he did echo the term RAND. Because I like to believe that Spotts believed in the idea without ever having tried to define it in my terms, because again, I believe I'm reasonably correct in making this estimate that it was Kolbaum who beat the drum using the acronym RAND. In other words, I didn't have, you'll see from the people I brought together for this meeting with Kindleberger and Douglas et al., it is an assortment of all the top dogs in the Air Force, O.P. Weiland on tactical air. I'm not sure of Eccles, but they're all named in here for that general meeting to try to diffuse the idea of making a broad study. I believe in Arnold's speech, I referred to the whole business as the problem of intercontinental warfare. Use the term.
Okay. But, I mean, do you recall any sort of specific connection in your mind relating the research and development position to the RAND idea?
I didn't associate LeMay with the RAND idea. I was trying to build into the Air Force some sense of understanding of the importance of technology. I didn't succeed, because that was the period when Arnold retired shortly. There was no one to guide LeMay. I mean, Aker was the last person brought, when I don't know how to describe it, but he was an unhappy misfit. And I had hoped that LeMay would, with his reputation for doing things, would take the bit in his teeth. I'm not sure he had any, but I guess he did. And remake the right field structure and Arnold's man in headquarters to propagate the faith. Now by that, I'm referring to Oliver Eccles, General Eccles. I came to know Eccles very well. And he, in effect, was the representative of Wright Field, its various faces, to Arnold in the headquarters. Now, he was a gentleman. I surmise reasonably bright, and I had a very good relationship with him. He was a man who could understand the reasoning, but in the Arnold structure, these people, in a sense, were without identification. Arnold was it. I don't mean that he had a lot of ego, but he was really in command. I won't say he was like MacArthur, because MacArthur, as I see it, was a very intelligent devil. Too much so for the people back in Washington. I couldn't slap him on the back, but I at least had some nice conversations with him out there. The Eccles came to me one day, or I came to him to talk about some of the problems on technology. And he said, Ed, I seem always to do the wrong thing for Hap Arnold. And like every witch doctor who comes from the out in the, from the open spaces, I said, Oliver, if I may be brutal about it, you don't understand Hap Arnold. When Arnold comes to you, he wants you to tell him what to do. Whereas you listen to him and you try to do what you think he wants. He came to you because he wanted your statement of what ought to be done. And I still believe, in retrospect, I was more nearly right than Oliver Eccles was, because you couldn't please Arnold that way. Now, that, I guess what I'm trying to say to you is Arnold was not a builder in the sense of being a, having a great mind. Arnold is a man noted for getting jobs done.
Okay. Go ahead.
In listening to you, I'm getting the impression that you seem overly focused on one aspect of what became the RAND idea, which was bringing technology and the recognition of the importance of technological change to the Army Air Force. And you ascribe this conservatism to the Wright Field and the technical services at Wright Field. But isn't this overlooking the converse, which is that although you're viewing RAND and it's the attempt to drag technology into the military as a failure, it was in some ways perhaps not so in perhaps not so much flattering way, very much a success. That is, it taught Colbaum and Douglas the importance of attaching directly into the core of the military to be their patron. That is, in a sense, that became a form of security for them. So sure, in a sense, it was really repeating the interwar practices in which a small number of contractors were affiliated with Wright Field. But instead of going through Wright Field, they went through straight through the command. So in a sense, they got to talk to Wright Field through the general staff as opposed to negotiating with them. A far more secure channel, it would seem, for their post-war sales. And in that sense, RAND is very successful from the corporate perspective.
It was an innovation, I suppose I can say. But again, I don't belabor the term because I don't think RAND was the term, the acronym.
The concept of, we're using RAND as a generic almost here.
Yeah.
To refer to this concept you had at the end of the war about the importance of linking industry and strategy.
Apart.
And how design needed intelligence as well as a proper perspective on what the actual battlefield was going to be as opposed to what the showroom was like.
No, that, you're right. I was a dreamer, I suppose. And I did have in mind getting into these joint studies. I was interested in getting into the economics of warfare, and well, come back to the Russian business, that making a study of the enemy, not just an economic study. Now with Russia, we were so fixed against Russia that all this, every indication was we're treating them as a dangerous adversary, but we were not putting our minds on some, I call it fundamental problems when I don't know the answer. We didn't really study Russia because it wasn't attractive, partly perhaps because of the language. People didn't know much about Russia, even if they wanted to, because of the barrier of language, getting into the study of the country. I had in mind that witness the Shockley job on Russian capabilities. Now, what we learned from that, at least I did, I don't think that report has ever seen the light of day because I wasn't good at propagating my faith. We learned that Russia had about the same capability as we had when it came to progress in applying technology to the development of new weapons. And the summary of Shockley's job was to the effect that we were neck and neck on this business of applying technology to military techniques or weapons. The only place we were ahead of Russia was in our ability in production. They couldn't equal that. Now, Shockley took a diffuse problem like that and handled it beautifully with all his genius. By the way, he came to my office defecting from the Navy. He was in the operation analyst group, and I was supplying most of the raw material to those boys at the time.
Was Shockley's project more of what you thought?
I beg your pardon?
Was Shockley's project on the economics of warfare more along the lines of what you thought, say, RAND and RAND-type projects
yes,
would be like?
Yes, exactly.
Did you not, then the B-29 study was in a sense a necessity, but not what you saw as a sense of long-term trend, say. I mean, that was something you had to do because you wanted a bomb, but you were, this was not going to be the everyday sort of problem.
See, if I understand your question, I'll try to give an answer. I had Shockley study the relative economic achievements of putting a bomber over Tokyo. And I can't remember, it's in my files here. I believe we found it was costing the Japs 20 times as much as we were investing into it. And they did that by making a study of the earthquakes in Japan in the 1906 period or something of that sort. In other words, a cataclysm. And he got raw material from that by which to try to make an estimate of the cost of the bombing to Japan. But I come back. I'm setting up Shockley as a brilliant mind in many ways. And I had hoped, again, that RAND would build up a staff competent to handle general problems relating not simply to the Air Force, but to air in general and the welfare of the country in general. In other words, the assimilation of the best of technology by actually giving it a hold on some aspects of real life instead of dealing entirely with economic scholastic implications. Now, RAND did later attract some very brilliant minds. That was after my time. And I don't think, maybe Kohlbaum would take credit for it. But Kohlbaum was a man who didn't have imagination. He thought like David Griggs in terms of, you might say meteorological ideas, vast and big. And as you'll see in this office record, he gets into a battle with Kindleberger, he just lived in an artificial heaven. I don't think he ever realized there might be a hell along with it. But But I'm a lost soul in trying to give you much help on this. I like the way you're looking at it all.
Yeah. Let's go at it from another slightly different way. You did the B-29 study. You had Shockley do some of these other economic impact type of studies.
Yeah.
So you had this core of reports and studies that provided a focus for this RAND concept. Okay, you were able to sell, or you were able to present it to General Arnold so that he accepted the idea and was ready to commit money to the idea.
Yes, that's right.
To what degree did you try to take this idea to other people at the top of the air staff? Let me just sort of give me the background for asking that question. You talked earlier about this meeting in 47 where you bring together some of the industry people, some of the air staff people to diffuse the idea. To what extent before that time were you trying to diffuse the idea, to make it known, to present the kind of results of these earlier studies that you had done?
I must say that's a very good question. I define very good as one that I can't answer. But literally, I suppose I was too much an opportunist. I knew that the main issue was Arnold. Narrow-minded, I grant. And I think it's reasonable to say that Arnold is an absolute monarch. He wanted to underwrite science, but he had no idea what science was. It was that kind of a mind. Now, I probably lost sight of propagating the faith by going out and preaching from person to person. Maybe I was protecting myself, but I never wanted to be a rabble-rouser in the sense of trying to stir all the minds up along my method of thought, because I was in alien country, strictly speaking, in the Air Force. And I thought the surest way to lose was to try to, I use the word, propagate the faith by going out. I didn't pick officers throughout the Air Force and try to sell them, using the modern idiom, on RAND. And in a sense, it was a failure for the reason that it needed to follow through, and I was naive in forgetting that Arnold was going to last just so long. And when Arnold passed out of the picture, then the things that you reflect came into being. In other words, the Air Force reverted to its original holdings. I mean, there were too many of the Ulsters in there. They could not seem to be converted. The highlight for me outside the Air Force was Joe McNarney, Deputy to Marshal. McNarney was an Air Force officer by training. McNarney, a most modest character, fitted perfectly as a deputy to Marshall. And not answering your question, but and not seeking the version, I had the feeling that Marshall belief in error was never appreciated by the Army. Witness the fight over air for air bombing and all that kind of thing. And the Navy was out of gear because this wild Indian who was going to sink all the airships, all the Navy vessels by bombing them from the air. I'm putting myself in Marshall's position in trying to estimate his function. He wanted an able Air Force man at his right hand, namely McNarney. Arnold was quixotic. It didn't worry him whether the pilots had shoes on or off or wore boots or what have you. He wanted results. Every time they wanted to send out a unit of Air Force combat boys, it was McNarney who did the inspecting behind the scenes to see that they were properly shod and had their adequate clothing and things of that sort. This did not appear. I don't say Arnold was ignorant or unmindful, but he was so interested in activity. They didn't worry about, as I say, whether they had or not they had shoes on. He wanted results. McNarney fitted this business of inspecting a unit, Air Force background.
Let's pause for a moment. We need to switch tapes here.